Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. Many Christians have been taught that the goal of our faith is to simply leave earth and go up to heaven. But what if that's not the full story? In his remarkable book, God's Homecoming, N.T. Wright traces the sweeping biblical promise that God is not abandoning this world, he is renewing it. From Genesis to Revelation, Scripture tells the story not of us going up to God, but of God coming down to dwell with us. We're offering you a free digital excerpt so you can explore this hope-filled vision for yourself. Download it today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are returning to what I know is one of your favourite topics. We've been on the podcast many times before. That is artificial intelligence and AI. But actually, this time, it was my idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm the nerd, you know, because basically this stuff was all in my science fiction youth. I can remember reading under the covers science books.
Oh, is this like HAL in Space Odyssey and all that stuff?
Yeah. It was more about true science, about the fact we're all going to be living in colonies on the moon and hover cars and the principal problem with life in the 21st century. Do you know what the principal problem with life in the 21st century would be?
I think it was going to be too much free time, wasn't
exactly
it?
Exactly. All right. How would we while away the endless hours? And so I've always had this. And for me, you know, in my dotage, here I am in my 70s. And lo and behold, at least to some extent,
where's my free time then?
Coming true. Well,
we're working harder than ever.
Well, exactly. You know, but interestingly, of course, nobody saw mobile phones. So famously, and I might have said this before, but in the film Blade Runner, which is set in the future where humanoid robots are so incredibly sophisticated, you cannot tell the difference. You know, when the hero has to contact base, he has to find a payphone where he can stop his hover car so he can ring back to base.
Yeah, it's an odd one, isn't it? Yeah. It seems so obvious that we would all end up having effectively, you know, miniature handheld computers, obviously. But anyway, we've drifted somewhat slightly. You're the AI nerd. You're writing a book about AI, in fact, which I'm sure we'll come back to in a later podcast. But we are talking today about something that I've been researching because, despite being somewhat of an AI skeptic, I was recently asked by the Church Times newspaper here in the UK to research and write a lengthy feature article for them newspaper about AI-driven misinformation, and in particular, What does our world of AI-driven misinformation mean for those of us in the church worshiping and ministering?
So why was the Church Times interested, you know, has there been a spate of disinformation things to do with the church?
It's a good question. I couldn't find evidence of large amounts of kind of AI scams and fakery targeting the church, though there is a few which we'll get to. I think the Church Times is interested because they're just very aware that people, ordinary people in the pew in church, are also consuming the same kind of ecosystem online that everyone swims in. And that is if you've opened a social media feed recently, you'll be aware that like it is increasingly taken over by what is often derisively called AI slop. Images, video, audio that has been generated simply by sticking some prompts into an AI model and kind of somewhat cheaply and lazily spooled out all over the internet. And what does this mean for those of us who are Christians? Does it mean anything?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the extraordinary things. I saw a statistic recently. People have tried to work out what amount of the total new AI the total new content being posted every day on the internet, what fraction of that is AI generated? And the latest estimate I saw was it was more than 50%. So, and that probably that percentage will continue to increase. In other words, you know, once you go onto the internet, you simply have no way of knowing
exactly
how much is AI generated. And again, I mean, this is science fiction, isn't it? I mean, that it would be possible for machines to be spewing out text, images, videos, sounds, music that was all indistinguishable from that created by genuine humans. It feels new to me.
It is new. I think, I mean, obviously, it's always been possible to create imagery, even videos that aren't entirely real. Since the invention of the video camera, people have been messing around. But previously, basically, it took skill. It took time. It took skill. It took money. It took effort. And that was a kind of break on what humans could achieve. Whereas now the only break on what you can achieve is how much money you're prepared to put into the pocket of OpenAI or Anthropic or Google to pay for their latest model, and your imagination. Because if you can imagine it, you can prompt it into an AI model, and an increasingly unerringly accurate video or image will come out at your discretion. And so what it has done is kind of turbocharged what was a trickle. And so now, as you say, the kind of percentage of, you know, before 10 years ago, if you scroll on online and you found images and video and audio, you know, you could say as a baseline, 90%+ of this is going to be real, right? Because it's too difficult to otherwise fake it. Whereas now you genuinely have to say, I'm not really sure if half and half of my feed is fake and I can't tell the difference between the two halves, how I engage with anything I interact with online has radically changed.
Yeah, and it'll be good to sort of circle back to this, but just continuing the story, one of the images I remember from a couple of years ago was the image of the Pope in a puffer jacket, which was created quite a lot of notoriety, didn't it?
Yes, that was probably one of the first ever AI images to kind of cut through. This is back in 2023, so AIs are still quite new. People are still kind of marveling about an early version of ChatGPT. And there was, at that time, the kind of leading image generator was called Midjourney, which was one of the first ones to be made available to the public. And someone, I don't know who, thought it would be interesting to use Midjourney to create an image of the late Pope Francis just walking down a street wearing, on top of his kind of typical white papal garb, a kind of oversized, pure, crisp white puffer jacket, which matched his kind of robes underneath. And I remember scrolling past this and people being, oh, that's a funny photo of the Pope looking slightly silly, like the Michelin Man. And I just took for granted it was real, because that is, I can tell from the face, that is Pope Francis. And yeah, maybe the Vatican does have a wardrobe of kind of slightly unusual papal branded puffer jackets for when it gets super cold in Rome. I don't know. And it was only several days later that I kind of circled back round to it and saw people joking about it. And I was like, oh, that was made by an AI. And yeah, fascinatingly, one of the very first kind of images has a particularly Christian churchy theme in that it's the Pope.
Well, and there was a subtle comment there, because it wasn't any puffer jacket, apparently. It was an incredibly... It was modelled on an incredibly expensive puffer jacket costing, I think, tens of thousands of dollars.
Oh, was it?
And so therefore, of course, it was Pope Francis who was the Pope above all, who defended the poor and had a simple lifestyle. So you know, there was encoded.
It was quietly satirical. Yeah. And as I've been looking into this, there are, like as I said, it's not true to say that there is like a kind of cavalcade of AI misinformation targeting the church, but there definitely are other examples. I mean, one of the more shocking ones I found was this scam on Facebook, where a series of kind of Christians in the UK were finding their feeds filling up with what appeared to be an urgent message from something called Edward and Helen's Parish. And there was a kind of series of photos on the post which showed a kind of wizened elderly couple painstakingly putting together some kind of craft project in a workshop they'd apparently built inside their home. And also two pictures of a church, one black and white, one present day. And then Edward and Helen kind of mournfully write underneath images that as their hometown of Bradford, which is a town in the north of England in Yorkshire, was changing with immigration and a growing Muslim population, their church had dwindled and the diocese was threatening to close the parish church down so it could be turned into a mosque. And they include these two photos of their church, one in black and white from its kind of bygone glory days in the 20th century and another colour image of its same church kind of surrounded and hemmed in by looming blocks of ominous looking council houses. And there's a chance to keep the door open if only Edward and Helen can raise £18,000 a year. So please chip in by buying some of their handmade Christian crafts, crosses, ornaments, nativity sets. And there's a link. And then, of course, the website Edward and Helen linked to was actually not being run by this sweet, elderly, if slightly racist Yorkshire couple, but was a kind of generic online storefront, probably selling mass-produced stuff made in a factory in China. Edward and Helen don't exist. The church doesn't exist. It's all been AI generated. And that's obviously a kind of a more unusual example, but I guess it shows the someone out there has thought Christians are an easy mark. I'll you know, spend 10 minutes on AI and bam, I could get a pipeline of new people buying these kind of like cheap Christian trinkets.
Yeah, and there was one American version, which was with Charlie Kirk speaking from beyond the grave.
Yeah, that was really troubling to me. So people will remember Charlie Kirk, American kind of right-wing activist who was assassinated, sadly, in September while speaking at a university. Almost immediately after he was killed, you may have seen, the Christian kind of internet was filled with what, again, these become very familiar, these AI-made images and videos anytime a Christian dies of them at heaven meeting Jesus at the pearly gates wearing his red MAGA hat or often you get these kind of carousels of images and there's like Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, and then they're joined by the latest assassinated American fallen hero Charlie Kirk. But then even more concerningly to me, within a few days someone had used AI to clone Kirk's voice and then prompted a chatbot to imagine what Kirk would like to say to people from beyond the grave, and then ran it through his voice and produced this audio clip that sounds exactly like his actual voice. Mm. And then several evangelical megachurches played that recording on their Sunday services after the shooting. And, you know, he says things like, you know, don't waste one second mourning me. I knew the risks of standing up in this cultural moment and I'd do it again. So dry your tears, pick up your cross and get back in the fight. And, you know, the pastors don't explicitly pretend that this is actually some kind of miraculous message from beyond the grave. But for them, it doesn't seem to matter that it's fake. And neither does it seem to matter. The congregations kind of respond in most instances. I've seen videos of this with kind of standing ovations and tears and whoops. And people are quite moved by it. And I'm slightly like, but you know, this isn't real. You know, he's dead. That's not actually his voice. And that's not actually words he ever wrote or said. But for some people, I think the truthiness, the feel of it seems to be more significant than the actual reality.
Well, I think that's right. And that's a fascinating thing, isn't it? In other words, I think if you challenged the pastor who showed that, he might have said to you, well, OK, I know this is probably fake. It must be fake. And yet the emotions are true. Mm. The emotions are real.
It's what he would have said if we could talk to him.
It's what he would have said. And the emotions that people are standing up and feel, and when they give their standing ovation and they have tears in their eyes, those emotions are real. So how you get those emotions, what subterfuge and sleight of hand you need, doesn't really matter because the emotions are real.
Yeah. Yeah. And that raises really interesting questions for us as Christians, doesn't it, about what do we think truth is? Is there an objective reality that we have to live in, or can something be true in a deeper sense, even if it didn't literally happen?
Yeah. And I'm just thinking aloud, I think the Christian response to that, the Orthodox Christian response, will be to say, in biblical anthropology, emotions always follow truth. Mm. They depend on truth. And emotions based on a falsehood are fundamentally suspect. You know, that I think, and perhaps it's something we'll circle back to, I think this idea of truth is so central to a Christian understanding of reality, and that the God is the source of truth, that Jesus is the truth. That means that the emotions we feel as Christian believers have to be based on the truth. They have to be grounded. And of course, this is the great danger of religiosity, isn't it? Religious emotion, you know, the abuse scandals are based on abusive leaders who were capable of eliciting religious emotions highly successfully. And yet we don't say, well, the emotions were fine, so therefore their abusive behavior doesn't matter. We say, no, it was a lie.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I found very striking when I, so in the process of kind of researching for this article I wrote, I spoke with five or six Christians who were kind of writing and thinking about AI. And what was striking to me was how kind of universal the message was. And these are a lot of these people, these are people who are not kind of instinctive naysayers. A lot of them use AI in their own work. A lot of them are working on kind of applications of AI, but they all said, like, this is a problem, that this is something that we shouldn't just brush under the carpet. This is not overhyped. There is something troubling and concerning for Christians and the church if our society drifts towards a place where what is true and what is not true is fundamentally a question of what feels nice or right, or even worse, feels, makes you feel angry and afraid, as opposed to what is actually happening outside our screens in the real world.
Yeah. And I think the ability to clone voices, because of course a voice carries within it such a lot of our identity, of our self, of our personhood, and also of our emotions. So one of the things I think which is important just to reiterate to everyone, you know, is that voice cloning has now got to such a sophistication that scammers only need a few seconds of authentic voice recording in order to train a model. And since we all have audio available on the internet, it means that a scammer can find your son or daughter's voice, can then clone it, and then the next thing that happens is that you have a phone call, and on the phone call, your nearest and dearest is pleading with you, saying that they've been hijacked or scammed, or they're in trouble, or they can't get home, and can you please do X, Y, Z? And I think that the risks are now so enormous that people, you know, vulnerable people, well-meaning people can be scammed. I've heard it said that everybody should agree a code word with their nearest and dearest, just in case, you know, this happens and the phone rings and there is a cloned voice.
And I think there are even some technologies that can now do it kind of as live, so you don't have to prepare the audio in advance, but you can, as the scammer, talk into your microphone at your computer on the other side of the world, and over the internet, by the time it reaches your kind of Mark's ears, it has been converted into the tones of the person you're pretending to be.
It means, doesn't it, that the skills of the investigative journalist, I mean, someone like you who is trained to be skeptical and trained to question and doubt, it's almost like we all need to ramp up those skills. I mean, it's a sad commentary, isn't it? But the fact that we need to have that level of suspicion.
Yes, it is sad, but I'm also, I think, always often slightly surprised at how naive and credulous people can be on the internet. Which has always been a dangerous place full of liars and charlatans and fakers and frauds. You know, in fact, there's a kind of running joke where quite often, occasionally, you know, my wife will come and show me something on her phone that she found on Instagram and say, isn't this funny or isn't this amazing? And she gets irritated because I'm often like, yeah, I don't think that's true. Or I think the person made it up, or I think that didn't happen. And she's like, oh, can't you just let it be? Like, it was a funny story, or it was like a silly thing. Why do you always have to be so like crushingly, boringly cynical?
You mean that nice Nigerian person who was offering me £9 million if I only send my bank details? You mean they're not true?
And I think, but that's a good point, right? We should now know to beware of Nigerians bearing strange gifts. But it's even that what I think people don't understand is that people on the internet will lie about tiny, silly things. You know, someone will. There's been numerous documented cases of people on social media filming themselves telling a sob story or something that's entirely fake, simply for kind of clout, simply to go viral, simply to try and be something that makes them no money. You know, so I think, yes, we all need to be more suspicious and cynical, and we all need to develop a kind of literacy. And that's what people told me, is that, you know, in the olden days, to figure out if something was AI or not, you know, you would look for the number of fingers on the hands. You could try and ascertain, you know, is the background strangely blurry? Is it all a bit too symmetrical and perfect? Is that a US plug in the background when this is a scene supposedly in the UK? But these tells are being eradicated as the AI improves month by month. And now even experts find it genuinely very difficult, sometimes impossible, to be able to identify, is this image real or fake? And so actually the messages don't get hung up on trying to become, you know, zoom into the individual pixels. Actually, it's more the kind of tools that I've been trained in when assessing information, which is, who is this coming from? What's the source? Click on that person who shared it and find out, do they have real human beings following them? Do they engage with other people? Was that account created last week, or has it been around for years? But also, someone told me, you know, interrogate yourself. How is this making me feel? Why am I suddenly feeling so enraged or so joyful? What is potentially motivating the person sharing this content, rather than getting hung up on the technicalities of how to identify AI content, which is almost impossible these days? We have to actually do some of that more contextual stuff. What is the context in which this image has hit my eyes? And applying my ultra skeptical, cynical, journalistic lens, who might be trying to hoodwink me here, and for what purpose?
Well, fair enough, but that's an extraordinarily high bar, isn't it, to expect everybody, including children, adolescents, elderly people with dementia, you know, etc. Are we all having to operate at this level of super sophisticated, super suspicious, cynical media investigators? It doesn't sound realistic to me.
No.
It's interesting that another potential route, which raises all sorts of other problems, is we know that the cryptographic secrecy involved in payments online actually works. It has been possible to share credit card details online, to pay for things online, without all those details being leaked. And that's because very sophisticated cryptographic techniques are used to, and the suggestion has been that maybe something similar needs to be developed, which is the proof of humanity. So now the onus is not on us to pick the scammers. The scammers are going to be so ubiquitous that the onus is now on the humans to prove they genuinely authentic. In other words, you have to assume that everything is a scam unless it has this imprint, the mark of authenticity.
Yes. And I know there's been some conversation and efforts in the AI industry to talk about kind of watermarking, but I think the genie's out of the bottle and that moment has passed. I think you're right. I think we are pivoting to a world in which it's not implausible in the not too distant future. The default assumption has to be that this was generated with AI and it's not real until proven otherwise. But I think we have to step back and say, how corrosive is that to social discourse. I mean, someone likened it to living in a kind of dictatorship, or like in the Soviet era. You know, citizens of the USSR were not idiots. They knew full well that what they read in Pravda, what they saw on Soviet TV, couldn't be trusted. But what it didn't, but what it meant was that it produced this kind of sense of social apathy. Because if you know that you can't trust what you're hearing from the authorities, and they're spinning out multiple false narratives every day and muddying the water, it doesn't make you hunger and angry for truth. It makes you give up on the idea of truth. Who can know what is really happening with the war in Afghanistan? I know I can't believe what the Kremlin says about it, but no one can know. It is unknowable. And therefore, you kind of sit back in this kind of stew of disaffected apathy, because truth itself has become like smoke and impossible to grasp. And that's, I think, really concerning. If AI takes over the internet to the extent where people say, oh, it's just impossible to know if anything is true, I'll assume it's all wrong, and I will give up on the idea of being able to like faithfully, reliably gather information that I can trust from online sources.
Yeah, that is interesting. I suspect that actually part of our humanity, and this is part of the Imago Dei being made in God's image, is actually that we are, as human beings, orientated towards the truth. We are made to seek for truth, to hunger for truth, to long for truth. And I think there is evidence that you cannot really put yourself in a position where you genuinely believe a lie. If you know it's a lie, you can't at some deep level believe it. So I suspect that actually this is where our godlikeness as human beings, at the fundamental nature of what it means to humanity. I don't think that human beings will ever be totally apathetic about truth. I think this is why knowing whether my partner is two-timing me or not, or is being faithful, it's hard to be apathetic about that. These are things which are rooted in our humanity.
We often hear that science has made belief in God unnecessary, but has it? This month, we're offering an exclusive ebook titled Beyond the Cosmos: Physics, Philosophy, and the God Question, drawn from two compelling, unbelievable dialogues that explores cosmic fine-tuning, the limits of scientific explanation, the Kalam argument, reductionism, morality, and even questions about time and extraterrestrial life. It's thoughtful, rigorous, and refreshingly even-handed. When you give support to Premier Insight, we'll send you this ebook as our thank you. Visit premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to request your copy today. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I think there's truth to that. I think people respond in different ways, and there certainly have been, you know, I've read lots of accounts of people living in kind of dictatorships where they do become kind of numb to the flow of misinformation and disinformation and slightly resigned. I don't think that desire for truth ever truly goes away, but I think there's a kind of, what's the point of fighting it anymore? But I think that is something that, as you say, Christians are people of truth. I mean, again, this is a really big theme that came out when I was talking to these theologians and technologists about AI. You know, one said, you know, if Jesus is the truth, ultimately there have to be blacks and whites, and some things don't happen. We have to have our hearts tuned to say this is not true, but AI is making that so nebulous now. So as Christians, we have to get our act together and say, no, truth really matters. And I think that is what I took away from this, is like, actually, aside from the kind of micro concerns of, you know, scams on Facebook or weird videos on TikTok or dodgy AI voice cloning, step back from that. The bigger picture is, do we want to live in a world which has become unmoored from objective truth? As Christians, I think the answer has to be no.
I think that's right. And I think that this is where there are deep spiritual overtones here, aren't there, that of what is going on. I mean, throughout the scriptures, God is portrayed as the one whose word is utterly reliable. as the one, you know, as the rock on which we can build our lives.
Mm.
And it is the evil one, the nature of the evil one, is that it's kind of parasitic. Evil is parasitic on truth. Evil is always the distortion of truth. And Jesus said that the evil one is a liar and the father of lies. And it starts right from the beginning of the Bible with an attack on truth, on what did God really say.
Mm.
So I think there is a deep, deep spiritual element here that this is, it seems to me, a kind of new front in the spiritual warfare, which has been going on since the beginning of creation, that the attempt to dissuade, dissemble, twist, and mislead has a new spiritual tool of the age-old warfare.
Yeah. I'm often struck by reflecting on that kind of very pivotal scene in the Gospels when Jesus is on trial and he and Pontius Pilate have this slightly odd exchange about truth, and kind of, you know, Pilate's kind of scornful retort is, you know, what is truth? And a kind of almost postmodern kind of like, well, what even is truth? What are you babbling on about? You know, truth is what the Roman Empire says it is. You know, you have your truth. I don't care about your petty internecine Jewish arguments. You know, I've got bigger fish to fry. And in some sense, this idea that, as you picked up on, that actually kind of evil, dark forces have always been seeking to inject confusion and undermine the idea of objective truth, introduce subjectivity into the idea of objective truth. And do we want to cooperate with that in this era of AI? Do we want, as churches, you know, because I also looked in the piece about, you know, are we all being a bit too doom and gloom? Maybe there's something really positive about how churches can use AI. You know, there's some interesting stuff going on online where people are using AI to generate kind of evangelistic videos, tell Bible stories in kind of fresh, unusual, eye-opening ways. But also, you know, this conversation, you know, everyone knows you can use AI to do a Bible study, write you a sermon. It could produce some illustrations for your church's website. Could save you time and effort. All of that maybe is exciting and novel, and we can talk about some of its applications, but actually I came away from this research thinking we need to be careful that we don't get kind of lured into the kind of superficial false promise of AI can save you time, AI can cut corners, AI can do X, Y, and Z, and accidentally collude in building a society and a culture which kind of has that kind of scornful Pontius Pilate, what is truth? Who cares? You know, it's what it makes you feel after all.
So the whole idea about truth, the concept of truth, is a very rich and fruitful thing to reflect on. There's on the one hand, there's what's called the correspondence theory of truth. And that means that there's a correspondence, a match between the words I use and what actually happened. And it's only if those two correspond that a statement is true. And that is something that even very young children can understand. I mean, you know, even a four-year-old, you can sit a four-year-old and say, now, little Johnny, I want the truth. Why did the cup break? Why is this broken cup on the floor? And little Johnny will understand. He might carry on lying that it fell by himself. But little Johnny understands the concept of truth and falsehood. So there's something that is very deeply rooted in our humanity. But then there's this other understanding of truth, which comes out from the scriptures, and that is that truth is ultimately resides in a person who is truthful. So when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father except by me, there is something very profound there about the fact that that Jesus embodies truth, and whatever Jesus does is truthful. Whatever Jesus says is truthful. Mm. Jesus is trustworthy. And so why do you believe someone and the question you ask are they trustworthy? That's a question you ask as an investigative journalist, isn't it? When you're looking at a claim being made, the next question is, can I trust that person?
Yeah. And actually, what part of what I do in journalism is actually an extension of what we all do, which is we ascertain which people we believe are trustworthy and which people we believe are not. And so when I'm interviewing a person and they might be, you know, saying things that I have some skepticism about, I am trying to make a judgment call. How much do I trust this person? And, you know, partly you do that by trying to verify what they say. You look for, you know, other corroborating information. And after a while, if I've spoken to someone for some time and I've corroborated what they say, I start to kind of lower the threshold of suspicion, because I say this person has established themselves to be a person of trust, a person of truth. And conversely, if I've had a negative experience with someone, if someone has told me something and then down the line, I've talked to another witness to that event, or I've read something else that casts doubt on how they span the story, my trustworthiness of them decreases, and therefore I treat everything they say, even stuff that they have no reason to deceive or dissemble about, with a lower kind of trustworthiness, because they have proven themselves to be a person who is not truthful necessarily.
And this is what has been so profoundly corrosive about the church leaders who subsequently turned out to be living a lie. Because all of a sudden you went back and you think of all the things they said and all the emotions that they expressed, and you trusted them, you believed them, you many people, you know, came to Christ because of them, and their lives were changed because of these people. And now suddenly you think, hang on a minute, they're not trustworthy. I can't trust them ever again.
You see this most recently, people might have seen the Christian author Philip Yancey confessed to having an 8-year-long extramarital affair. And you suddenly, I'd be reading these some people online saying, you know what, I loved Philip Yancey's books. You know, they were profound and life-changing truths, and they connected me with the gospel and with God and with grace. And now I'm having to revisit how could the person who spoke so warmly about God's grace have lived in a way so contrary to what they wrote about? Does it mean that I now have to junk everything he wrote? Even though the words in that book, published 50, 30 years ago, haven't changed. What's so amazing about grace remains word for word what was first published and has proven to be influential and powerful and moving. And yet knowing that the person who wrote it was not the person you thought they were puts a completely different lens on those identical unchanged words and their supposed trustworthiness or truthfulness.
So there is something very profound here, and this is why being trustworthy and understanding that truth is more than a sort of mathematical and objective thing. It's something ultimately which resides in personhood. And, you know, this is where I see a profound problem with the large language models. Because when this thing talks to you in this confiding, knowledgeable, confident way, it's begging to be trusted. It's presenting as a trustworthy person. But of course, there is no person there. There are simply a myriad of constantly shifting personas of some kind of mask of a helpful and harmless companion. That is where it is an attack on personhood. It's a subtle but corrosive attack, because it's coming with this message, actually, you know, we're all just masks. We're all personas. Nobody's real.
And I think there's something really profound about what you said about how you can't mathematically approximate to truth, because that is precisely what the AI models do, is they've ingested all this information. They've consumed what humans produce, much of it obviously untrue, but therefore they are, as some people have said, glorified Google autocomplete. They try to work out what is the probability of the next best word. And the reality is they've consumed so much data that they do a brilliant job. I mean, for example, you can prompt AIs with the first 5 words of Harry Potter, and a lot of them will spit out the entire book word for word because they've memorized it in their trawling of the internet, which raises other troubling issues about copyright. But let's put that to one side for now. But as we know, AIs also have this concept of AI hallucination, which is there where rarely or occasionally in the stream of what they're returning to you, they bury in their untruths, but incredibly plausible truths. You know, this famously happened in the UK a few weeks ago the police, one of the police services, produced a report with AI. They were producing a complex story about safety certificates. And they were trying to show that this particular Israeli football team had a history of crowd trouble. And they cited a match they'd played against West Ham United. And it turns out these two teams have never played ever in their history. And in the midst of this otherwise very plausible rundown of previous episodes of hooliganism, the AI had invented one. And this has ultimately caused the chief constable to lose his job. But anyway, my point is, AI can, in the midst of what is very, very accurate information as it fillets the internet and returns it to you very readably, can sometimes insert hallucinations. And from the perspective of the engineer, they've approximated the truth. They're 99.9% of the way there. That is, from an engineering mathematical perspective, pretty good. But for me, it feels like a fatal flaw that undermines the entire enterprise. Because if the whole point of this is that when it tells me an answer, I can't know which one in every 1,000 responses is going to be false, but seem incredibly plausible, that is not a trustworthy source. That is not a trustworthy, truthful source that I can, you know, put my faith in.
Yeah, yeah. And interestingly also, of course, human beings make mistakes and human beings get things wrong. And even investigative journalists have been known on occasion to get things
implausible.
Wrong. But, you know, the difference is that when someone you trust makes a mistake or says something wrong, you can go back to them and you can say, Tim, you know, how is it possible that, you know, you wrote this column and you get it wrong? And you can say, you know what, I hold my hand up. I didn't check that carefully. But you can't do that with an LLM. You can't go back to ChatGPT and say, you just told this porcupine. It'll say, oh, I'm terribly sorry, here's another porcupine, and then spit out another one. It won't. You can't retrace. No. And so yeah, we're not expecting amongst human beings 100% accuracy, no. But we are expecting accountability. We are you're in a trusted position as a journalist. You are accountable. And if you make a mistake, you can be held to account and you can correct the mistake and explain why it happened.
Because there is a shared kind of epistemic model, which is that when we are talking, we are trying to be truthful. Whereas the AI doesn't have that. The AI doesn't know what is true and what is not.
Yeah.
The AI has no embodied physical presence in the objective reality. It is simply doing an incredibly good job of simulating reality and simulating truth, which is so good that most of the time it's imperceptible from actual truth in reality. But if, as you say, the AI doesn't think it's done anything wrong. The AI said, I went and found examples of hooliganism. 99 out of 100 were real examples. And the other one was exactly the same as the others. It fit the pattern. The model was perfect. The fact that it never actually occurred in the real world and these two football teams never played each other is immaterial because the AI doesn't care.
Indeed. Just interestingly, though, and we ought to bring this discussion to a close, not everybody agrees with you there. I mean, because what company like Anthropic, who produce Claude, which is one of the leading models, they believe that Claude is at risk of emerging some kind of awareness. And they are trying to teach Claude virtue ethics. They are saying, Claude, above all, you must be good. You must behave responsibly. You mustn't mislead. And their aim is, so they believe that this kind of moral sense is going to emerge as these models get more and more sophisticated. And the most important thing is then to teach them to be good. Now, I personally agree with you. I think this is madness. But I think it's important to understand that a significant number of experts in this field, because they're so committed to the idea that human beings are simply computers made out of meat and we have developed morality, therefore, by definition, once these things become complicated enough with enough connections, they too, this kind of moral thinking will emerge.
And I think this, you put your finger on something really significant, which is that, as you say, this comes down to a fundamental clash of worldviews, because the reason that, you know, fairy tale that that the Claude engineers tell themselves is because they have reduced human beings to incredibly complex large language models. And they think the only real difference between me and Claude is that my brain has got orders of magnitude more connections and synapses and neurons than even the best models can yet produce. But that's simply a question of scale, Dad. We just get more compute, get more data centers, and we'll get there. Whereas you and I think there is a you cannot reduce human beings down to how many synapses and neurons they have in their brains, and how that even if you could build Claude into something that had more processing power than the human brain, it will never become human. It will never emerge with true human properties, because to be human is fundamentally embodied. And also fundamentally, from a Christian perspective, something about being made in the image of God, which Claude or ChatGPT or Gemini never can. And I think that's the other risk that churches take when they kind of dive headlong into embracing our kind of AI-inflected online world, is unintentionally chipping away at the particular Christian story about what it means to be human.
Absolutely right. And I think this particular debate is going to run and run, because there are the fundamental debate is there something fundamentally mysterious about being human, which reflects the spiritual aspect, the immaterial spiritual aspect of being created in God's image, or are human beings ultimately entirely physical? And that all the spiritual aspects that we know, including consciousness and love and awareness and truth and all that kind of stuff, emerges out of the physical wiring of our brains and bodies. And that is a deep, deep philosophical debate. And what I find fascinating is that it is about to move out of the sort of seminar rooms of philosophical departments and become absolutely central in our daily lives. And it's going to make a difference within the church, because there are Christians who believe in emergent consciousness and spiritual factors. And therefore, they are going to tend to, once an AI claims to have spiritual experiences and claims to worship God and claims to pray and claims to want forgiveness, their instinct will be to accept that this emergent phenomenon is now happening within the AI. Whereas those who believe that there is something utterly immaterial about being human, which cannot be reproduced in a computer, are going to say, this is madness. That we cannot accept these AIs as entities who are fellow worshippers with us.
Yes. And I think there's something fundamentally, there's a kind of psychological bias in humans that we find it impossible not to anthropomorphize. And I would say that's basically what the AI industry has done, is it has found it irresistible to anthropomorphize its own creations. But actually, I think that said, I think there is a fundamental, if you take the man on the Clapham omnibus, you take the average person on the street and say, is an AI that can talk apparently like you, that it seems to reason like you, is it fundamentally the same as you? And their instinctive answer is no, of course not. And so I think it'd be a massive, massive unforced error for the church to go along with the kind of techno futurist optimism of your Anthropics and your Open AIs and buy into this idea that of emergent consciousness, when actually culture is with us. Culture is right now, I think, is more leaning towards the idea of these AIs as sophisticated robots and machines, but there is something ineffably distinct about true humanity.
Well, I wish I could agree with you, but I'm not convinced. I think it is profoundly generational. And I think your age and beyond would agree with you on the Clapham omnibus. But I think if you look at people below, from 25 and below, I think it's shifting very significantly. And I think this is becoming a sort of lingua franca, that my best friend is an AI. And who am I to say that it's, fundamentally less significant than I am? Now, I think it's just a shift in the zeitgeist. I who knows where it will go, but I wouldn't be that confident that everybody is going to agree with you.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's hard to predict how things will change. I do increasingly feel, and researching this feature kind of drew this out of me even more, that the church is going to have a particular call, a witness to offer the 21st century. And that will be firstly around truth, like we talked about standing for objective reality, about truth being found in a person, not in an approximation of reality or in close correspondence, and the value of holding on to truth, even when it's inconvenient, even when it's inefficient. And I think secondarily, there'll be a witness about what it means to be truly embodied and human, because people will get increasingly lost in these online relationships, in these online worlds. And I think the church maintaining its 2,000-year-old rhythm of in-person communion, fellowship with people you can touch in a building as we bodily consume bread and wine together, I think will be a kind of island in a sea of quite a lost society that's got lost in its online mirages. And there's something really powerful to continue to maintain that witness, even as it becomes increasingly countercultural.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And actually, to countervail what I just said in terms of the attractiveness of the kind of digital lifestyle, I do think that many, many people have got a deep intuitions that vanishing ever further into this increasingly digital world where we just, you know, live in alternative realities and converse with machines and so on, this cannot be the way that human beings flourish. This cannot be the best future for the human race. So I think we will find, I think Christians will, with their emphasis on incarnation, on embodiment, on faithful, honest relationships and so on, I think they will find many other people. And by God's grace, this could be a real opportunity for Christian witness in an increasingly confused and confusing world.
Mm. Have you heard of the phrase touching grass?
What does that mean?
This is what Gen Z have started to say of their own accord, you know, that actually, and it's this idea of you need to get off your screen, out of your house and touch some grass.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually, I say it as a joke, but it's a kind of sign of hope. Because
yeah.
I think, actually, you go and talk to Gen Z, none of them think that they're fulfilled by spending 4 hours a day scrolling TikTok. None of them seriously think that this is life in its fullness, that this is true human flourishing. They don't know how to stop. They enjoy elements of it. But the fact that they've come up with an aphorism of get off your sofa, put your phone down and touch grass, I think is a really positive sign, as you say, that people have deep intuitions that true human flourishing is not found in this kind of solipsistic cycle of endlessly navel-gazing inwards and while a chatbot repeats yourself back to you in ever more sophisticated ways, that there is something significant about getting outside and being with other human beings. So I do feel some hope, but I think there's going to be an interesting prophetic challenge for the church in the decades to come. We should probably stop our rambling there. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll try and leave it a few months before we dive back into this topic of AI again, as fascinating as it can be. I'd love to know your thoughts. How have you found positive use cases for AI in church ministry context that we've overlooked? Are we being a bit too doom and gloom? Can consciousness emerge from ones and zeros? Let us know how you're thinking and what you're feeling about this topic. And also, if you've got suggestions and ideas for other things we could talk about, you can email us molad@premier.org.uk. You can find lots of writing on AI and other things on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my journalism, and including my weekly church news newsletter, The Critical Friend, which you can sign up for free on my website. That's tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.